Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and as often as I can, I try to jump back in front of the microphone. I have a different role in the network now, and interview the author of a book that I find particularly interesting. And today, I'm very happy to say that at long last, I'll be talking with Claire Clark about her terrific book, The Recovery Revolution, The Battle Over Addiction Treatment in the United States. This is one of my pet topics. I've been involved in the recovery community for 13 years now, and I'm always interested to read what serious-minded researchers have to say about the history of recovery in the United States and also elsewhere. We did a book on the treatment of alcoholism and drug addiction in the Soviet Union, which was fascinating as well. But I'm particularly interested in the recovery movement, I guess you would call it, in the United States. I really enjoyed this book, and I encourage you to go out and read it. Claire, in any event, thank you for writing the book, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Marshall.
Absolutely. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I was dual trained in both history of medicine and behavioral science. I got a PhD and an MPH at Emory University. And I currently teach in the University of Kentucky's College of Medicine in the Department of Behavioral Science.
So can you tell us why you wrote The Recovery Revolution?
Sure. So I guess like many of the folks you interview, my book started as a dissertation. And when I applied to graduate school and interviewed at Emory, I was coming from a kind of media and cultural studies background, and I was sort of interested vaguely in therapeutic culture. And I interviewed with the person who had become my advisor, Howard Kushner, who is a historian of medicine. And in our interview, he gave me a book which had just been issued in the United States. It's called What's Wrong with Addiction by Helen Keane. And he said, someone has written the book that you proposed to write, or dissertation that you proposed to write. And it was a phenomenal book, and of course he was right. He did sort of two really smart things when he handed me that book. And the first one was to tell me not to write something that someone else had done, obviously. And the second thing he did was a little bit more subtle, which was to push me to expand my evidence base. As kind of a cultural studies person, I was very used to just analyzing things on the level of text. And my advisor really pushed me into doing more archival work and more, I guess, what you could call empirical research. So that was sort of the first part of the genesis of the book. The second part was that my second semester, my first year of graduate school, there was a large conference at Emory bringing together historians and scientists and different people who were studying addiction. And at that conference, I met David Courtwright, who's a very well-known historian of addiction, and he handed me a card which was the contact for a bunch of oral history interviews that he had done. I believe he and his colleagues completed them in 1981 with people who had been in addiction treatment in the mid-20th century United States, and also with a bunch of treatment leaders. And those primary sources were really kind of the genesis of where this project came from.
That's terrific. That's a terrific story. It sounds like you had a great advisor.
He's still a great advisor.
Well, right. And that first piece of advice, your book is already written. Hard to beat that one.
It's true.
Talk about avoiding big mistakes. Yeah. Well, he saved you a lot of time. So in any event, let's get into the material in the book. Could you tell us a little bit about the prospects for recovering from, well, first of all, the diagnosis of and the prospects for recovering from drug addiction prior to what you call in your book the Recovery Revolution, which begins in the late 50s and really centers around the genesis of a pretty common thing today, and that is therapeutic communities, places where people go and live in order to get better.
Sure.
So well, can you talk about that early history?
I can. So there were two sort of treatment eras that came before the one that I talk about in my book. And the first one was really in the mid to late 19th century, there was a paradigm for understanding addiction that was called inebriety. And it's a understanding of addiction that's actually very similar to the one we have today, in the sense that addiction was more understood as a process that had sort of both behavioral and biological and psychological or even moral components, and that it was the same kind of diagnostic category no matter what the substance was. So you could have inebriety having to do with tobacco or having to do with alcohol or having to do with narcotics. And so treatment centers at that time were really more of kind of a catch-all. And so you had asylum, some publicly funded ones, but a lot more sort of private ones. That model of addiction treatment was, for various reasons, discredited. And by the 19-teens and 1920s, what had been, compared to what came later, a pretty extensive network of treatment centers had pretty much entirely dried up. And as most people probably know, right, in the 19-teens and 1920s, the way that the nation, the U.S., decided to deal with substance use was to start outlawing things. So, you know, outlawing narcotics and then outlawing alcohol. What happens with the repeal of alcohol prohibition is that really the kind of diagnostic category of inebriety, which had was already on the downfall, really kind of splintered. And so the way that scientists and treatment centers started to deal with narcotic addiction, and by that I mean mainly heroin versus alcohol to a sort of lesser extent cocaine, and then an alcoholism or alcohol addiction were two sort of very different things. So that people who were addicted to narcotics in by sort of mid 20th century, really there were sort of very few options for treatment. The way that the nation decided to address treatment was to invest in they're kind of colloquially known as narcotics farms or federal narcotics hospitals. There's one here in Lexington, Kentucky, where I now teach and live, and then there was one in Fort Worth, Texas. And so those narcotics hospitals, they had some people that would sign up for treatment voluntarily and then some people who would be sort of sent there by the criminal justice system. But if you had a problem with narcotics from about the 1930s until about the 1950s, really 60s, those were your two main options for getting treatment.
Mm-hmm. And how big were these narcotics farms? They're run by the Fed, right?
That's right. They were run by the U.S. Public Health Service. Mm-hmm. They were relatively...
You don't have to know. I don't know.
I don't know the exact... I can't tell you. I could dig through my files and pull up the records that I have to look at the exact statistics, but... I couldn't tell you the exact.
Yeah, well, judging by the picture of at least one of them, which is a quite beautiful Art Deco building, does it still exist?
Is the building? It does. Yes,
it does. That's a very nice building. They were big.
It's a prison.
They were really big. Yes, exactly. Yes. There you go. And what did people do at these narcotics farms?
Well, there were a sort of wide variety of types of treatments there. So there were group therapy sessions. There were individual psychoanalytic therapy sessions. There was an experimental wing where different types of scientific experiments having to do with drug addiction were run. So it was really kind of a hodgepodge of different treatment models. People were looking to see what might work. And what, you know, emerged out of the lesson that is told, and it's told in other places. So, you know, Nancy Campbell, J.P. Olson, and Luke Wilson and Luke Walden have a lovely documentary about this in a book that goes into the whole history. And then Nancy Campbell's Discovering Addiction and Carolyn Acker's Creating the American Junkie sort of deal with this history in more depth if people are interested in looking into it. But one of the major lessons to come out of this experiment was that this notion of kind of corralling people who struggled with addiction into a central location and then sending them back to their communities where they have their same social networks, their same triggers, very little support for behavioral change was unlikely to promote long-term recovery, and that many, many people relapsed under those conditions. So mm-hmm. And this is sort of leading up to really where the narrative in my book starts, by the late 1950s, there was starting to be some kind of, and early 1960s, some kind of recognition that there needed to be a wider treatment system. And you really start to see the transition to a more community-based model of formal treatment by that time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right, well, let's jump forward to, I don't know if it or he is the protagonist of your book, but plays a major role, and that is Charles Chuck Diedrich. Is that right? Again, I can't get his name right. Is his name
Diedrich.
Right? Diedrich, yes. I'm sorry about that. The founder of an institution called Synanon, which, as I say, I did not know about. Could you tell us about that story?
Sure. So Synanon was a spinoff of AA, and it's people who have heard of Synanon probably know it kind of in the tradition of new religious movements or cults because it devolved somewhat famously. The story that I'm interested in or was interested in telling about it was sort of how some of the public relations and branding and therapeutic model sort of laid the groundwork for addiction treatment. So its influence on addiction treatment rather than its kind of very dramatic rise and fall as an organization. But really what Synanon did was, so the founder, Charles Diedrich, was an AA member. He was in recovery from alcoholism. He was a salesman by training, and he saw a kind of market opportunity in the late 1950s for the treatment of people who were struggling with drug addiction. It was getting to be a kind of, the subculture of jazz coming to more prominence. It was getting to be a more recognizable kind of social problem. And like I said before, the federal narcotics farms were coming to be widely seen as sort of massive failures. And folks were, and all kinds of, there were various constituencies who were kind of casting about for an alternative. So he saw kind of a market opening there. And what he did with Synanon was to take the AA model and adapt it in a couple of critical ways. So the first one probably being that AA, as you know, is really it's peer support. It's not treatment. It's self-supported. You know, AA groups don't bill to insurance companies. And he really wanted a treatment center that was going to be really an enterprise, essentially, right? That was going to make money, could potentially even be recognized as being a medical treatment instead of just sort of peer support. So he really had a plan to kind of corporatize the treatment model. The second thing that he did was AA. There is this tradition in which, as you're probably familiar, you're not supposed to crosstalk. So people share their stories, and then everyone listens, understanding, you know, and with kind of sympathy. And then you talk to your sponsor afterwards, or you work out the details mm-hmm. of what you're going to do outside the context of the group meeting. Well, the kind of prominent notion about people who were struggling with narcotic addiction at the time was that they were incorrigible human beings, that they were in denial, that they were sort of seriously dysfunctional, and that they needed a kind of tougher therapeutic intervention than AA. So throwing out that whole no crosstalk thing and turning meetings into essentially what was called sort of confrontational therapy, where the other members of the group, through confronting each other, sort of break down the defenses that they've built up. And then the idea is that outside the group setting, the community helps you remake your personality in some more healthy and beneficial way. So those are two things. First, the intention to really turn the model into an enterprise. Second, the kind of confrontational nature.
And in 1958, this was apparently a very appealing idea.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Yeah, I mean,
yes.
People glommed onto it. Even though, let me just take a step back. Diedrich made all this up, right? I mean, this was his intuition about this. This is not based on research. He didn't talk to doctors. He didn't conduct experiments and focus groups.
Well,
he didn't do anything.
Yeah, it came out of the experiences of the sort of group of folks that he had assembled. So it uh-huh. was kind of schismed off of an AA group in Southern California.
It's funny you mentioned this because if you've been in AA as long as I have, you hear stories about what are essentially called rogue AA groups that they always tend to move in this direction. Is the first thing they do is they say, okay, we're going to allow crosstalk, mm-hmm. which in AA is a big no-no. I've never been to one of these meetings, but you hear about them all the time. I remember there was one in D.C. in the early 2000s where it went rogue and it had kind of a cultish leader. And, you know, they were allowing, there's even a place in the, I think it's in the Big Book or the 12 and 12 where Bill Wilson says, you know, we've determined that what he calls the, I like this expression a lot, the frothy emotional appeal does not work.
Right.
But AA meetings will sometimes tend in that direction under certain kinds of leadership. And so it doesn't surprise me that it kind of organically evolved out of a rogue AA group. It's hard to call anything a rogue AA group because AA really doesn't have that many rules, and it certainly has no one to enforce them. So
right.
It's hard to say they're rogue because it just is what it is. So he develops this model. And is there a name for this kind of thing? Does he give it a name?
Well, okay, so the name Synanon, there are sort of various origin stories about where it came from. So, you know, some people say it was someone bungling, trying to pronounce symposium or seminar. In some of the early press about Synanon, it talks about Synanon as being kind of Sinners Anonymous, which is, if that origin story is accurate, I mean, it is a kind of callback to this sort of Victorian notion of inebriety, right? And that all sins are kind of the same. So that, you know, and it fits in keeping with the sort of ideology of the treatment, which is that it is designed to remake your sort of whole personality, not just stop a single behavior. Mm-hmm. And I guess one thing that I do try to get across in the book is that part of the reason why there was this kind of market opportunity is also because there were really a lack of therapeutic options for people who were disenchanted with the narcotics hospitals, who maybe were unsuccessful in psychoanalysis, which might have been another option if you had quite a bit of money. And so really, you know, it was in some ways a kind of grassroots movement of people who had been sort of cut out of really any kind of effective mainstream medical treatment and had a lack of therapeutic options. And they said, well, we're going to organize ourselves and we're going to invent our own treatment and we're going to promote it. And what, I mean, really the story is that what these sort of recovery revolutionaries did is they made a kind of Faustian bargain, essentially. Because in sort of taking control of their own destiny and saying, if, you know, the current treatments are failing us and we're going to treat ourselves, but the way that they went about selling that treatment, in some ways intentionally reinforced all of the very worst stereotypes about people with addiction. So it wound up backfiring in some fairly tragic ways.
And this I think, if I could editorialize for a second, I don't know if it's editorializing or simply stating historical opinion. This is where Bill Wilson and that group were really very clever very early on. They did toy with the idea of opening a series of treatment centers for alcoholics, but they decided essentially to make the groups independent of one another and especially to double down on the anonymity aspect of it. And what they say is, in the Big Book, they say that they wanted to be anonymous because they were afraid that if they weren't anonymous, that too many unrecovered alcoholics, practicing alcoholics, would beat down their doors and their lives would be ruined. But that isn't really true. The reason I think that they emphasized anonymity was so they wouldn't have dramatic failures in the press. And it worked pretty well, right? You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You can't really say it's a failure if you don't know anyone in AA.
There's also what you see in putting the burden of proving that, or attempting to prove that, people who are struggling with addictions of various types, when you put it on those people, it also creates a tremendous burden and stress. And you see sort of center after center kind of collapse under that as well.
It does. It does. But the shield of anonymity has worked really well for AA because, you know, again, I'm a big proponent of Alcoholics Anonymous. It saved my life and so on and so forth. But it's a very clever organization. It does what it does very well. And I think it's largely because it didn't go the route of Synanon and into the public sphere where it could be measured and poked and probed and criticized and things like this, which is eventually what happened to Synanon, is that it became famous. I mean, really famous, and the people in it became public figures, as in the case of Diederich. He became
exactly
famous.
And what you've hit on there is when people ask what's the difference between AA and therapeutic communities, that's the difference. You've just sort of summed it up really nicely.
Well, and also, although there are a lot of there are a lot of therapeutic communities for alcoholics. We just generally call them halfway houses or something like that. But that's an important difference as well, is that I think what Diederich had in mind was a place where you lived, right? From the very beginning, he wanted people to live there. He wanted it residential treatment. Is that right? Whereas AA isn't like that. There's no residential AA.
Right. But there was also a need for residential treatment
for
this population at the time.
Yeah, I'm not saying there wasn't. These people were largely indigent. And there's another kind of aspect of this too that sort of, it ties into a book that I did a long time ago called by a historian, and I don't remember his name, but he wrote a book called Smack. Are you familiar with this book?
Eric Schneider.
Yes, exactly. And he wrote this book about essentially how the heroin culture in the late 1940s and early 1950s went from black to white. It started among black jazz musicians as a kind of a cool thing to do, and then jazz became popular, and then white populations started to do heroin. And you can kind of see that once that happens, then there's money behind it, and the situation that gives Chuck Diederich his opportunity to found Synanon, suddenly there's a kind of pool of resources that's ready to be put behind this enterprise. Because the other thing you haven't said, I mean, you did say it, but and I think this is something the alcoholics run into sometimes too, is that there just weren't any alternatives in the medical community. If you read the introduction to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, essentially the doctor's opinion, he says, we have no cure for this, and you're going to die. That's not what you want to hear when you go to a doctor, right? Especially if it's your son or daughter. Like, sorry, no cure for this. That's it. It's done. You need something. And I think that what Charles Diederich did is they created something.
Exactly. And so there's ways in which it is a revolution, because it's a revolution against the existing options. And it's an alternative to the way that people have been sort of locked out of the medical system and medical treatment.
Well, it's the last, they say in AA sometimes it's the last house on the block, the last one you go to. And it's kind of true, but there really aren't any, what other option is there? I get frustrated with people that say, this or that would work better than AA. I'm like, you should definitely start that program because we need it badly.
Right.
But anyway, let's go back to Chuck and his endeavor.
Sure. So part of another thing that kind of interested me about this topic, which has to do with sort of what are the different therapeutic options, because now obviously there are more therapeutic options, is the way in which treatment is kind of is branded. And this could be all kinds of psychotherapies, right? So that if somebody could say that they're, they do yoga, they do life coaching, they do support groups, they do therapy, those, whether different types of treatments are considered sort of hip and desirable or are considered stigmatized varies across time as they kind of rise and fall. If you think about psychoanalysis being the treatment model in the mid-20th century, and now nobody does it, right? And they also vary depending on people's social location.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's funny you mentioned psychoanalysis, because I was sort of that... Nobody does it. I'm sure you didn't mean that, but it turns out a lot of people do it, and they're in New York City.
Well, right, exactly, but not across the country anymore.
No, but I mean, exactly. You're right about the geolocality. Yeah, I mean, the locality. I mean, they're in New York City. I mean, we have a channel called New Books and Psychoanalysis, and there are a bunch of analysts, and they live in New York, and they have a bunch of patients, and they're in New York. So,
right, or Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I grew up and have spent much of my life in the southern United States, and for many communities here, it's sort of not religious enough. It's heretical, right?
And just the opposite,
right? Among academics who are kind of more secular leftists, it's the opposite. So, Synanon and we'll get into the therapeutic communities that came later are a really good example of the way that treatments develop kind of brands, and they become either desirable and they become stigmatized. And then that has public health implications, whether or not people want to enroll in them, for example. So,
And Synanon in 1958, I mean, AA had a kind of I don't call it slow, because by the standards of the development of national institutions or even international institutions, it was very fast. It had grown very large over about three decades into the millions of people. But Synanon took off much more quickly, didn't it?
Yes, it did. So
I mean, just one quick thing or indication of that, it's founded in 1958. In 1965, there's a Hollywood film about it. Is that right?
Exactly. And in 1960, when John F. Kennedy comes into office, there's on the federal level, people are looking at what are some different alternatives for treatment. And there are some high profile meetings are convened, and you know, the people who are there to represent the constituency, the people who need treatment, are from Synanon. So they insert themselves into policy debates at the national level really relatively quickly. And yes, the film that comes out in 1965 is kind of a fictionalization of a series of news articles that they sort of coordinated leading up to that point. So they do. They come to prominence relatively quickly at sort of right place, right time.
And initially, it's you call them therapeutic communities. In other words, it's a place where you move and you stay there and you undergo whatever sort of therapies they have. In this case, they have the Synanon game, which is what we just described. That is where they have this kind of, I guess I would call it tough love kind of peer counseling. And you live in I don't know if it's a total institution, but it's an institution that regulates your life very closely. But then pretty quickly, it's open to people that aren't addicts. How does that happen?
Right. So this is why I kind of move on from at around 1965, I start kind of moving the book, starts sort of moving away from a close discussion of Synanon to looking at the what are called second generation therapeutic communities that spun off of Synanon. And we're much more influential in terms of addiction treatment writ large in the country. Mm-hmm. And that's because Synanon starts marketing itself, sort of transforms to marketing itself as kind of a social movement, and less concerned with sort of solving the addiction problem and more like a kind of utopian vision of an alternative society. Mm-hmm. And so while they do continue to treat people, that sort of the nature of the organization changes. And the way that they go about sort of recruiting people into it changes. And the decision to align themselves really with sort of the addiction treatment enterprise lessens somewhat. Many of the people who became sort of influential founders or co-founders or early members of the therapeutic communities that came later are sort of leave Synanon and go on to found these second generation centers.
Right. But just to be clear, and you haven't said it, but I think it's a proper characterization. It becomes a full on religious movement.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, just full blown religious movement with Charles Diederich at its head.
That's correct.
Yes. Right.
So and there are plenty of books on, there are plenty of books on that. They're sort of, they're all in the bibliography, right? And that's, you know, largely Synanon. When it has been studied, it's been sort of studied from that angle. And so, yes, full-on religious movement with forced vasectomies, with, this is much later, and, you know, taking up weapons and there are a lot of sensational things that I could have gone into, but I sort of move along into looking at really the influence that it had on the centers that came.
Right. Well, let's talk about that second generation, which, as you say, is much more influential. I mean, and the descendants of that second generation are still around.
Right.
So go ahead and talk a little bit about them.
Sure. So so some of Synanon's early leaders leave, and they go on to found centers in New York. And so some of the most prominent ones that are still around today are Phoenix House is a big one, Daytop, which was incorporated into a different center, is still around today. And what distinguishes those therapeutic communities, and that was the term that they they adopted. What distinguishes them from Synanon is really the idea to kind of to become a legitimate medical treatment, in the sense that they would employ people to do research, they would apply for federal grant money, they would do outcome studies. And so to take this grassroots movement and to mainstream it somewhat and attempt to medicalize it somewhat. What happens is there with some of the early data from those centers and some of the early kind of anecdotes of successful treatment cases get taken into account when on a more national level, under Richard Nixon, the nation starts looking at investing in some different treatment models, really scaling up community-based treatment across the nation.
Mm-hmm. And about how many of these second-generation institutions are there? And they also get, they become very organized at this point. They get a professional association, don't they?
That's right. Therapeutic Communities of America. And that comes about in kind of the early mid-1970s, now called Treatment Communities of America. They become competitive for grant dollars, which federal grant money starts by under the Nixon administration, starts to become available for funding addiction treatment and for studying addiction treatment. These centers start to try to, you know, position themselves as really kind of the vanguard of a new nationwide addiction treatment infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. And are they, or do we know, were they effective at that time? They were founded in the mid-60s and early 70s. The second generation around
that's
then?
Yeah, that's right. The first couple were sort of like early 60s, and then mm-hmm. you start to see more and more as kind of the 60s go on, and then in the early 70s.
Daytop is the first of them, if I recall, right? Daytop comes from Synanon directly.
That's right, and so does Phoenix House. Uh-huh. Well, so the book, I'm pretty careful about saying that I don't make clinical recommendations.
Okay.
So it's not really about what's more or less effective. I can tell you some kind of themes in the research about them.
Okay.
So the model is still based on a kind of psychopathology model, and that you want to, a more positive way to say it would be that it's a more holistic view of the disorder. And so they were looking, the early studies they're looking at things like recidivism and criminality, because a lot of, you know, they don't mm-hmm. want to see people re-offending. And a lot of the impetus for providing funding for this sort of thing was as criminal justice prevention, right? But they were also looking at what are some different indices of psychopathology and things like that. So there are sort of various scales that look at how thoroughly people have been kind of psychologically transformed by the treatment. And then they also look at, length of abstinence was a sort of major indicator, how long people stay abstinent. The biggest finding from some of those early studies was that the longer people stayed in a therapeutic community, the more likely their outcomes were to be on those various measures once they were released, which kind of makes sense. People who leave, right? They probably leave mm-hmm. Because they didn't want to continue with treatment also.
Right.
But there was almost a dose response relationship with the amount of time that somebody stayed in a community and then how well they were able to improve. And then that allowed people who were proponents of the model to make an argument for a really holistic, long-term residential form of treatment.
Is that where we get 90 days or something? What is it, 28 days?
So that was actually, I think that came later and with managed care. And that was a problem for advocates of the therapeutic community who believe that, a person needs to be completely transformed by treatment and that it's a very sort of long-term, rigorous process. But at this time, folks were getting support for putting somebody in treatment for a year and a half, 2 years. And it's not, I mean, it's in some ways, it's sort of unsurprising that, as you said, if you put somebody in a completely different social environment for that length of time, that they would change in important ways, right?
Sure. So. Sure. So one of the things in your book that kind of, I guess I kind of knew this, I don't know, but the Nixon administration in particular seemed to be quite interested in what we would call even kinder and gentler ways to deal with addicts. So you do a little bit of rehabilitation of Richard Nixon. The other thing that happened, I think it was during Nixon's presidency, was the introduction of, and this was a revolution, methadone maintenance treatment. How did that affect the therapeutic communities in that movement?
Sure. So methadone treatment is what we call today, you know, medication-assisted therapy. And that emerged in the mid-1960s as a kind of, I guess, people within the therapeutic community movement characterized it as a sort of stark contrast, almost like a villain or something, you know, in contrast to their treatment model. But methadone is a medication-assisted therapy that really helped people who were struggling with narcotic addiction reduce their craving and met their helped reduce some of the kind of like biological urge to use. People in the therapeutic community movement were coming from a philosophy of total abstinence. And so there was kind of rhetoric around any kind of medication-assisted therapy as being like a form of false consciousness or substituting one drug for another sort of thing. What's interesting is that even though methadone, there are some very famous studies that show that it helps bring down criminality in districts that are affected by sort of upticks in heroin use. And that's really where the Nixon administration becomes interested in investing in addiction treatment, is as a form of kind of crime control, which was a major political concern of his. And the drug czar that Nixon appoints, Jerry Jaffe, has worked both with medication-assisted treatments with methadone and with therapeutic communities. And when he's kind of ushered in, he's sort of one of the few people that has a kind of more ecumenical attitude about it. And he believes that these different types of treatment can be used in combination. And he also, he has a kind of thousand flowers bloom attitude towards treatment, that the government should just fund the different models, and then it's up to the people who need the treatment to decide what will work best for them. And it's also kind of like make the nation a laboratory and see what works. So that's what happens with the federal funding in the 1970s, is that you see a major federal investment in methadone, but you also see some of the therapeutic communities at the time begin to have influx of federal funds. And less commonly, you do start to see some centers that kind of attempt to combine the two models, with Gateway, which was the center that Jaffe was involved with in Chicago before coming to work in the Nixon administration, being kind of a pioneer in that movement toward integration.
Mm-hmm. But what does the medical establishment say about methadone at the time?
Well, which part of the medical establishment?
Oh, what I mean is, I mean, people that actually treat drug addicts and alcoholics. So I guess my question is, if I remember correctly from the book, that the medical establishment is actually quite keen on methadone because it doesn't really buy the therapeutic community method. And also policymakers are very keen on it because it seems to offer mitigation of harm, if not recovery. Do I remember that correctly?
That's correct. And it is a more medical model of treatment. So so it's sort of, you know, it's run by doctors, right? Predominantly, not sort of people in recovery, right, who've come up the ranks. And
these are people
and it can be scaled up relatively quickly, right?
And it was
scaled up relatively quickly, because if your treatment model is requiring people to be in a community for 2 years, right? And then go on to lead another community, that's going to take a very long time to sort of propagate if you
but the legacy of method, I don't mean, again, I'm mm-hmm. not talking about the effectiveness of method. It is effective in terms of harm reduction, at least social harm reduction. But, you know, I live in a very nice town in Western Massachusetts where people are, you know, pretty well-to-do and so on and so forth. And there's a methadone clinic half a mile from my house, and there's a line in front of it every day. It's downtown,
right?
Just for convenience sake, next to the expensive apartments and stuff. So that stuff spread like wildfire, and you can easily see why doctors and policymakers would get behind it.
It could be it could be scaled up quickly. It was is a much more medical model of treatment.
And so was there a struggle between the proponents of methadone in terms of a struggle for federal dollars, I mean, between the proponents of methadone and the TCs?
They were both kind of making the case for funds at the same time, and the methadone people would say, you know, therapeutic communities are they're cultish, they're unscientific, you know, they're et cetera, et cetera. And then the therapeutic communities people would say, you know, the methadone is just trading one drug for the other. It doesn't address all of the sort of various social components that we need to pay attention to in dealing with addiction, et cetera, et cetera. And it's interesting because a lot of those same debates, sort of pitting the two models in contrast with each other, persist today.
I was going to say the same thing.
Right. Yeah. They persist today in the United States, and they've been, interestingly, you know, they're exported to other countries even,
I know some heroin addicts or people in recovery from heroin, and they will say the same thing about methadone. That is, it just substitutes one drug for another. And it is helpful in the sense that they're not out robbing jewelry stores anymore, but they're still addicts. And they still act like addicts. So, I mean, I'm not taking a stance on this. I'm just
But the genesis of these debates is really this period from 1965 up until the early 1970s, really.
But, you know, the one thing you point out in the book, and this is a fascinating thing to me because I see it sometimes when I go to AA meetings, is that there was a lot of faith, at least in the criminal justice system, put in therapeutic treatments. I don't know if that's redundant or not, but, you know, just to give you an example. So at an AA meeting, you'll commonly see people come in who've been mandated by the courts. And this happened as well with narcotic treatment, right? Were people mandated to the TCs? Did the courts get involved?
They did. And so, you know, I think that when Jerry Jaffe said, you know, we should have therapeutic communities available and we should have methadone available. And then in sort of like an ideal therapeutic utopia, people would just, they would all be run and on the up and up, and people would choose the centers that are most compatible with their own belief system and ideology. That would be great. When the funding model shifted, when funding models shift, then sometimes treatment centers are looking for other ways to get kind of influx of dollars. And so therapeutic communities did start to rely on, they always relied on referrals from probation officers and things like that. But they came sort of increasingly to be relying on referrals from the criminal justice system sort of into treatment.
And did the therapeutic communities like these referrals? Or I know at AA there's sometimes talk, I won't name any names obviously because I don't know any names, that court mandating is a bad thing. You should walk in on your own two feet. Was there any opinion in the late 60s, early 70s about the courts getting involved in sending people to TCs? If you don't know, you don't know.
I don't think I address that directly in the book. I do think that the model presumes that if you could, that once you get someone in, if they stay in for a long enough time, they'll be transformed, right? But that if they drop out early, then they don't get the benefits of treatment. So, I think in that sense, it might be less important how they get there, and more important whether they stay there.
It's tough in that case to decide which way the causality goes, though. I mean,
it
you
is.
Know, like somebody, somebody comes to AA and actually stays and gets clean and stays sober for 20 years. Maybe you just say, well, they were ready. And AA didn't do anything for them. On the other hand, you can say, well, they actually stuck it out. And after 5 years, they realized the promises, as we say, and they stayed clean. So I don't know which way that goes. I really don't. I will say this, though, just as a digression, the first, I'm actually leafing through the book. My listeners can probably hear that. The first line in your book, I thought was just one of the best things I've ever read, because it really needs to be, it needs to be expressed to a lot of people who think about this issue. And I'll just read it. Preface: the majority of people with substance use problems solve them without formal addiction treatment or 12-step groups. And that's true. That is absolutely true. Most people who have problems with drugs and alcohol, they don't use any of these things. So I was very glad to see your book open with that.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yes, I read that. I'm just like, I like this book already. Because I think that's generally too. Spontaneous remission is the most common way in which people kick, I think. It didn't work for me, but I think it does work for a lot of people. So let's go on with the book in another era. One thing I like about your book is you talk about these eras. And so I remember very well the crack epidemic and Nancy Reagan's drug tour, Just Say No. So can you talk us a little bit about that and the way to impacted the therapeutic communities?
Sure. So therapeutic communities got a kind of boon, at least a rhetorical boon, from the sort of drug war policies of the 1980s, because, again, it was a kind of abstinence-based treatment, which was very compatible with the kind of the national campaign of Just Say No. And in fact, when Nancy Reagan sort of first launched her campaign, she launched it at a therapeutic community treatment centers. And she became interested in it because of people that she knew socially who were affiliated with therapeutic communities. And part of why I say this story is a bit of a Faustian bargain is because in this case, I think many folks within the therapeutic community movement expected to see some more federal dollars coming from the kind of PR campaigns that they saw being launched. And in this case, really, you know, the Just Say No and drug war policies were much more much less interested in investing in treatment, much more interested in urging the privatization of treatment, and in kind of using treatment centers to further their kind of political rhetorical goals. So unlike under Nixon, where, you know, Nixon visits, where later on in his career, Nixon visits Daytop and is very complimentary about therapeutic communities. Unlike in the 1970s and the 1980s, there really isn't sort of federal funding that kind of comes behind whatever endorsements might come along with the Reagan era drug policies.
And this is sort of a dry season then for the therapeutic communities.
They have to begin. They start courting referrals from the courts and finding sort of various other ways to stay afloat.
Now, at what point and I think our listeners will want to know this, do insurance companies become involved and people begin paying?
Well, that's later. That's a bit later by the 1990s, where you start to 1990s, you start to see a little bit more of the influence of insurance companies, and therapeutic communities have some difficulty adapting to that because the model is much more long term than insurance companies generally want to pay for, and that's when you start to see the model moving, or I would say they were always kind of present in the prison system, but that's when you start to see more therapeutic communities moving into the prison, because it's a long-term treatment model is compatible with a carceral model in some sense, because you have people who are going to be someplace for a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years.
Right. Well, I was thinking about it in the context of privatization, which is, you know, kind of a drumbeat you hear every time there's a Republican administration. They talk about privatization of this or that, and usually privatization in the therapeutic sense means insurance companies and private clinics. Did this happen to the treatment of people addicted to narcotics?
It did. In the 80s, you saw addiction treatment shift from, there were some documents that a colleague passed along, and you start to see the demographics shift from to include sort of more youthful, to enlist more youthful people into treatment, and then you start to see a shift from publicly funded treatment to privately funded treatment that occurs in the 80s.
Right. There are a lot of places you can go now. I mean, there are places you can go and get what is essentially residential therapy for narcotic addiction if you have insurance, correct?
Today or?
Yeah. I mean, there are these places. I don't know anything about them, but sure. They do exist. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Sure. Right.
Yeah. And are they related to the therapeutic communities? Do they adopt practices from the early therapeutic communities? Did the same people found them that founded therapeutic communities? Or I guess I'm just interested in the issue of privatization and how far it's extended into drug treatment. I know a little bit about the history of it in terms of alcohol. You know, we could talk a little bit about Betty Ford, if you like, and how kind of a large industry and the Hazleton model and these other things that are essentially I think they're for-profit addiction treatment centers, correct?
So I think with therapeutic communities in the 80s, if therapeutic communities were getting federal funding, it was coming in the form it was either local or coming in the form of kind of block grants.
I see.
By the 80s and 90s,
right.
And there is a push to diversify the client base. So that meant that you were either going to court people who were sort of higher income and had means and had insurance and were going to be able to pay for treatment that way, or you were going to have your clients coming to you as referrals through the criminal justice system or within the context of prisons. So there were kind of like various ways that the kind of pure form of the therapeutic community, if you could call it that, a second generation communities, in the 1970s, had to change to adapt. So either by moving into the prison system or becoming more entrenched, or by changing the model in different ways to accommodate different types of therapies or even medication or shorter stays. So there are centers that you could walk into today. While I was in graduate school, I worked at the CDC and we evaluated a bunch of different types of treatment centers. The variety there's much more variety now than there was in the 1960s. There are some places you can walk into and it looks like a treatment center straight out of 1965 or something. There are a few, there are a handful. But for the most part there's a lot more, variety in addiction treatment today and a lot more choice. But this issue of branding that I kind of talked about at the beginning that I'm really interested in, I think is still really important because people, if we have a lot of choice, how are people making their decisions about where they want to go? That it has to do with the options that are available to them, but then it also has to do with factors having to do with, the historical moment we're in and their social location. And why are there so people are still making decisions to enroll in abstinence based, right, versus medication and assisted treatment.
Sure. So again, these are not, I don't think you answer these questions in the book, but just for curiosity's sake, how many therapeutic communities are there in the United States today?
Well, hard to say because, I think even, they don't even really call themselves that anymore. Traditional ones.
So, branding, more branding.
So the Therapeutic Communities Association of America, they're the Treatment Communities Association of America. I think that there are a lot of treatment centers that are influenced by the history and by the model, but even the treatment centers that are part of this kind of historical second generation have changed in really important ways since their founding. So I don't know. I there are probably zero to five in terms of the ones that would call themselves still therapeutic communities.
Yeah, today. Sure. But there are hundreds of them, aren't there? I mean, I see, you know, you can ride the bus and see advertisements that say, you know somebody in trouble? Well, come to Wellspring, where we'll treat you for a narcotic addiction. And I don't know what Wellspring is. I mean, I just made that up, but that's the kind of name they have. And I don't know what sort of cred they have or what sort of, is there a system for authorizing them in any way, you know, accrediting them?
There is. It's called CARF, I believe, is the accreditation agency. So there is a system of credentialing. And then if centers are receiving government money, then they do have to meet sort of certain mm-hmm. kinds of metrics, and they have to be investigated and things like that. You know, there are granting requirements and things as well.
So here in Western Massachusetts, and I think in the nation at large, we commonly hear about this thing, the opioid epidemic. I don't know whether there is one or not, but I've heard a lot about it. Has there been any response in the therapeutic community to this, or has the federal government allied with the therapeutic communities to help in battling this supposed epidemic? And the only reason I say supposed is because I haven't done any research on it, and I don't know. But
sure. So I published a kind of follow-up op-ed a few weeks ago that had to do with this, although it didn't necessarily deal with therapeutic communities directly, but dealing with sort of like the way that funding for addiction treatment has ebbed and flowed through these various eras, right? From the Anybriety Asylums to the federal narcotics farms to the scaling up of addiction treatment in the 60s and 70s to now. And part of the problem is that we've never really been able to build a kind of sustainable national infrastructure. There are just huge gaps and cracks that people mm-hmm. fall through, and that we have a history in this nation of sort of cyclical funding, so that there's some kind of epidemic, as there is right now, as there was in the 60s and 70s. We pump a bunch of money into it and then have no sort of political will to sustain that funding. So I'm afraid that that's what's happening now. And one of the lessons I think that from the book is that in making the case for funding every time this happens, there is a way in which sometimes even treatment proponents depict people who are struggling with addiction as being somehow subhuman, as being either subhuman or fated to die or already dead or horrible human beings, in addition to pejorative terms like addict, depictions of people as being zombies, etc., in a way that ultimately I think works against our ability to summon the political will to have any kind of long-term sustainable treatment infrastructure for people.
Yeah, I have, as a former... well, I don't know, former anything. Somebody you talk to, as somebody who had real problems with drugs and alcohol at an earlier point in my life, I can tell you that, and still deals with them quite a bit, drug addicts and alcoholics are not the most sympathetic group. Let me just say that.
It's true. So when you're trying to make the case for treatment, really, and this is what some recent research on recovery shows, is what you need to try to do is explain the lifelong process of recovery and how beneficial that is, and try to get people to empathize with that, because most people can understand going through rough spots in their life and needing some kind of support to get through it, right? But they understand that addiction is this horrible thing and the people are not sympathetic and blah, 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 but they don't really understand what recovery is. So that is one of the lessons of this history that I try to tell in the book, is that that this continual emphasis on being a horrible person and then needing to be redeemed or needing to be even punished as a form of treatment in some kind of ways is ultimately sort of detrimental to addiction treatment kind of writ large.
Yeah. From your lips to God's ears, I think is what I would say to that. I think that one positive development I can tell you in my time dealing with these issues is that I think the stigma involved has lessened appreciably. I don't feel particularly stigmatized as somebody that had real problems with drugs and alcohol earlier in my life. I know that some people do, and I'm aware of that, but I would say that generally speaking, the amount of opprobrium which is heaped upon that afflicted group is less than it's ever been, certainly in my lifetime, which I think is a good thing. So that's a very positive development. I'm less sanguine about the effectiveness of the various treatments, including AA, that we have, because there's no magic bullet here. Recovery is a very complicated thing. You know, it really gives one pause, I have to tell you. It's a tough deal. I personally was very lucky, and as were many of my friends, but I know lots of people that were not. I'm also interested in where do these dollars go. So are the dollars coming from the Fed in the states and localities now? Are they flowing at a higher rate now than was the case before the opioid epidemic, as it's called, hit the front pages?
Yeah, so there have been a couple of pieces of legislation that have dedicated more money to it. But the problem is that and the problem, of course, is that these kind of like influx of money every time there's a crisis is a really ineffective way of dealing with the problem. So, you know, something like ensuring more people, you know, making sure more people have health insurance that mm-hmm. can cover addiction treatment is better than these kind of stopgap measures where we pump a bunch of money into treatment for 2 years and then hope that the right people can kind of get to the treatment in time.
Right. Well, I mean, it afflicts such a large proportion of the population that maybe we should have something like unemployment insurance. We could have like drug addiction insurance. Since you stand something like a 1 in 15 chance of being addicted to drugs or alcohol in your life, you can just pay a little bit every month from your paycheck and hope it doesn't happen to you.
Oh, you might be on to
something. Actually not a bad idea, I think, really, to be honest with you, because it is so common. I mean, really, it's amazing how many people it afflicts. Well, I we've taken up a lot of your time, Claire. I'm sorry we've taken up so much of your time. And I want to reserve the last couple of minutes to ask our traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
Sure. Thanks, Marshall. So currently my job is teaching, as you said, teaching medical students in a college of medicine. And my next project is more education related. So I don't know if you'd heard this, but they've added a new part to the medical college admissions test that's on the behavioral and social dimensions of medicine. So pre-medical students are going to have to learn a little something about other factors that influence health. There are a lot of sort of test prep books out there or videos about it, but I'm working on a kind of educational text that will be a reference for people who want to use humanistic methods as to teach about behavioral dimensions of health and medicine. So can we teach about these things using literature or art or history instead of using test prep videos on Khan Academy is the idea.
Yeah, that's good. Although videos are a good way to teach people. I got to say, whenever I want to learn something new these days,
I use videos all the time in my class too. But academic presses don't want to publish them for some reason.
No, they don't really want to publish videos. It's funny because I was just, well, this is a long talk. But videos are good though. Good way to teach people. Totally good way. I encourage you to keep using videos. And you can make them, you know.
I made a bunch of them. I do make them, actually.
You can make them. Stick them on YouTube and millions of people will watch. So there you go. Anyway, let me tell everyone that we've been talking to Claire Clark about her wonderful book, The Recovery Revolution, The Battle Over Addiction Treatment in the United States, and what a battle it was and remains. So Claire, let me say thank you for writing the book and thank you for appearing on the New Books Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Marshall.
Absolutely. And let me say to everyone that listens to the New Books Network and the various podcasts therein, we really appreciate your support and we appreciate your listening to our channels. And I hope to talk to you soon. Bye-bye.